from WNYC New York Public Radio. This is the podcast of The Leonard Lopate Show. This is just one segment of the program. You can hear all Leonard's interviews on demand at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
Was Benjamin Franklin America's greatest diplomat? Well, Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer Stacey Schiff makes a strong case for it in her latest book, A Great Improvisation. In it, she explains that the man who invented bifocals and tamed electricity actually made his greatest contribution to history when he persuaded the French government to bankroll the American Revolution. Without France's money, which would be $13 billion in today's dollars, the colonies almost certainly would have lost to the British. Stacey Schiff's book is published by Henry Holt, and I'm very pleased that it brings Stacey Schiff back to my program today. Hello.
Hello, Leonard. Thanks for having me back.
And do all of those people who were promoting Freedom Fries a few years ago know about this?
I think those people could be counted on to avoid this particular book, actually.
Did France buy independence for America in a way?
I think you can pretty much say that. Certainly without France, there would have been no American independence. Congress is, you know, when you think about it, retrospectively, obviously, Congress does an amazingly foolhardy thing in declaring independence in 1776 without the means to achieve it. I mean, it's really kind of a crazy act.
No guns, no ammunition,
no guns,
nothing.
No, and as Franklin says later, you know, why the world wondered why we did not fire a cannon. The reason was we had no gunpowder, but we kept this secret even from our own people. I mean, there's an amazing sort of lackadaisical approach here to making revolution.
Now, King Louis XVI was on the French throne then. He still had his head. Wasn't he at all reluctant to support a revolution against a monarchy?
It's interesting. Louis XVI is, oddly enough, an almost minor player. It is his ministers who are lobbying so hard for American aid. It's his ministers, in fact, who've had their eye on an American revolution for almost longer than we have had our eyes on an American revolution.
But the French are a colonial power. Doesn't this set a precedent that they really do not want set?
The French are a colonial power, but do not believe that the American colonies, as they then existed, those 13 colonies, would ever amount to any kind of viable, vigorous power. So they felt it was perfectly safe to let, it was more important to them to wreak revenge on the British and support these 13 rebel colonies than to think about the greater implications for the world, because to the French mind, these were 13 colonies who didn't like each other. The North and the South had nothing in common. They were strung along a long coastline, which was geographically kind of unwieldy. They were fractious. They were irresolute. This wasn't a viable entity of any kind.
And the French were totally aware of the ins and outs of colonial politics?
The French, interestingly, and this is one of Franklin's greatest, one of the greater banes of Franklin's French existence, the French have a representative, otherwise known as a spy, really, in Congress. And they know more, Versailles knows more about the infighting and the ineptitude in the American Congress than even does Franklin as he's sitting in Paris. So yes, they have an extremely close eye on what's going on in American politics.
A lot of spies here. In fact, some of your best material comes from
some of my best friends were spies. Exactly. Franklin is the most famous man in the world when he lands in Paris, and he is immediately encircled by two nets of spies, by the British, who of course wonder what this great rebel has come to incite in France, and of course those spies are encircled by French spies. So essentially the first half of the book was based on these two marvelous sets of dispatches. These were very verbose spies, and they sent things back regularly to their superiors about Franklin's and the Americans' behavior.
Has anybody gone through those reports until now? Because, you know, a lot has been written about Ben Franklin.
Really? Is that true?
We all know. And yet you seem to have come up with all sorts of new material.
I was very fortunate to have a lot of new material. Some of this is simply a matter of getting to it. The French spy reports, for example, are really known as the French surveillance of foreigners reports. And they are in the French State Department archives. They are hard to get to. They are in French. They are moldy. They are somewhat illegible. And some of them are still not decoded, in fact, 200 whatever years later. But they provide an enormously candid and intimate portrait of Franklin's day-to-day existence.
So you had to move your family to Paris to work on this?
Some of them kicking and screaming, some of them with bells on, exactly.
They must be very happy by now.
The material was terrific, and it was well worth sort of plunging into those archives.
The New Yorker's comment on the book was, yet another book on Benjamin Franklin would seem to be the last thing that anyone needs to cut down trees for right now. But this meticulously researched account captures a key moment in his history and in ours with verve, elan, and wit. That's nice. Had anyone written much about the 8 years that Franklin has spent in Paris before now?
It has been written about. It's been the subject largely given to diplomatic historians for obvious reasons. And it's a subject which has figured tangentially in other studies of Franklin's life, particularly of Franklin's social life, since some of his great flirtations are with French women, in fact. But no one had ever followed that piece of rather forgotten American history through using Franklin as the centerpiece. And that was what really appealed to me, was here's Franklin in his role as rebel. And that's not something, you know, we think of Franklin the scientist, Franklin the inventor, Franklin the publisher. We don't really think about Franklin as rebel or statesman.
Well, what about the other statesmen? Was he the first one we sent out? I know John Adams was in Amsterdam. John Jay was in Spain.
Adams and Jay follow Franklin. One man precedes him, who's a Connecticut businessman, a kind of very dapper, not quite up to the task businessman named Silas Deane. And it's he who actually goes first and arranges for the underhanded help that the French government provides before Franklin's arrival. And he is, in fact, the only colleague, until the arrival of Thomas Jefferson in 1784, with whom Franklin gets along.
Did Franklin, was he sent there because he spoke French?
He was sent there, he sent in 1776 for a constellation of reasons. He's the best known American in the world, and he's the only American who really has a sense of foreign affairs as they then existed. He's the only man, he's been in London for 15 years as a colonial agent. He's the only American who can really stand as a statesman. And yes, it is understood that he speaks French, which he does very badly.
So,
as the next years will reveal. Yes.
Because diplomats should speak fluently.
I don't think that's ever been an American belief, has it, that our French ambassador had to speak French?
Well, maybe we wanted translators who understood the nuances of language. Did he have trusted translators?
He did. He did an exceptionally good job recruiting the best possible people for the task. He gets a wonderful kind of retrospective report card. It was said that his spoken French was a B+, and his written French was essentially an F. It was extremely bad written French, but he had other people who filled in for him.
He also was the only of the founding fathers who hadn't gone to college. So he seems to me to be the less likely person to be considered a good diplomat.
That's where much of the strife comes in with Franklin and his American colleagues in Paris. He's the lowborn upstart among the founding fathers. And his colleagues in Paris are most of them Southern aristocrats. They're planters and they're men with immense fortunes. And they never, there's really a sort of class division at play among these Americans in Paris, and particularly because these Americans are very resentful of the fact that Franklin is the great celebrity, that Franklin is the apple of the French eye. And they can't quite get over the fact that this, you know, guy whom they think of as not belonging to the American establishment could be so revered.
Was there also a generation gap? He was older than most
Huge.
Of them.
Huge. He's the founding grandfather. Franklin is 70 when he sails, which is really unthinkable even in his own day. He's outlived many of his generation, and he's nearly 80 when he comes home.
Was he a spry 70 into the 80s?
He's a relatively spry 70, and he's a relatively immobile 80. He begs for his last 2 years in Paris, once the peace has been signed, and until he actually sets sail in 1785, he begs rather poignantly to be allowed to come home. And at the moment when he finally gets the permission to do so, he's rejuvenated. He bounds from his bed, you could say, and into the boat and says he's never felt better in his life. He's so desperate to sail for America.
What qualities or skills made him such a good diplomat?
You know, Franklin had something that perhaps many old people have, and none of his colleagues shared, which was an enormous amount of patience. And so much of what he does, especially for the first year and a half until he gets the news of Saratoga and he's able to do something with it, which in this case is to forge a French alliance, so much of what the job required was waiting. And this drives his younger colleagues out of their minds, especially John Adams. It's an old man's game. It's a bluffing game. It's a waiting game. It's a game of few words. And he's a reticent man to begin.
But you also suggest that the things that made him a good scientist made him a good diplomat. He had uncommon openness to new ideas.
Franklin gets in trouble with particularly John Adams for changing his mind often. And interestingly, that very flexibility is what makes him so suitable to this particular task. I mean, here's a man who had outlined a plan of American Confederation to repel French attack originally, and now applies that sense of America as a cohesive country against British attacks in soliciting French aid. It's a marvelous about face. And he often says he has no particular investment in being right. He's just lobbing these ideas out there in the hope that they might serve someone.
That made him a unique politician, didn't it? Because politicians, no matter how many times they change their minds, always find a way to make it sound like they've been consistent.
Consistent all along. I'm not sure he was ever a terribly good politician, which I think he would have said himself.
But you've called him a genial con artist. What do you mean by that?
there's an element to this whole, to the entire French mission of sheer con artistry, not only in the sense of kind of, you know, a Mark Twainian hero who, you know, leaves home and puts on a disguise and sort of sets off on the lam to work some kind of magic, but in the sense that Franklin, essentially for the first year and a half he's there, invents an America and an American Revolution, which are utter fiction.
So he's conducting diplomacy by the seat of his pants.
It's seat of the pants diplomacy, hence the title of the book, but it's also almost a Franklinian hoax, as he so often did in his newspaper. He sits in Paris and he spouts these amazing anthems to the future of America, when, so far as he knows, the American Revolution has barely got off at all, to start at all, and Washington has reeled from defeat to defeat to defeat.
And he can't know a lot because it takes a long time for any kind of communications to reach France from the fledgling United States. I don't know how long an ocean voyage was in those days.
On a good day, 30 days, but that did nothing for Franklin's mail. At one point, he goes 18 months without hearing from Congress. And they, by the way, 18 months without hearing from Franklin, which, of course, leads to this assumption on the American side that good old Ben is sitting in Paris doing nothing. So there's a rather a misunderstanding there. He's dilatory, though, about writing, and it's one of the things for which he can truly be faulted in Paris. As he says later, I'm getting old, and I don't particularly like to put pen to paper anymore.
So he's not sending back stuff and giving them an idea of what he's doing.
He sends back relatively little. Both sides realize, both Congress and Franklin realize, that everything they write is going to be broadcast to the rest of Europe, that these spies are collecting everything, intercepting everything that goes back and forth. So it behooves them both to be careful as to what they said on paper. That said, Franklin is still quite a bad correspondent.
Have we found out who most of these spies were? Do we know who was in Congress?
We know who most of the spies were. One of them does a delicious job of secreting reports out of Franklin's house weekly, which he rides across town and puts in a bottle and he sticks under a tree in the Tuileries. And those papers go back to England every week. And they can all today be read in the British Library, in fact. And we know who he is because 60 years after his death, a paper surfaces, which is the 19th century already, in which he essentially had requested back pay for his services to both sides, to both the British and the American causes.
So he was a counter-spy who wanted to get his double pay.
But an extremely gifted counter-spy, since no one, even among the French informers, had figured out that he was the leak in Franklin's household.
Now, you say that he was received quite well by the French when he arrived. Why did they know so much about him? Why was he so famous?
As a scientist, Franklin's reputation as the man who tamed the lightning is really his passport to Europe. And years earlier, any American who came to Europe reported that the first question out of anyone's mouth was, do you know Dr. Franklin? You know, who is this mysterious wizard who has tamed the heavens? And France is the first really to take interest in Franklin's scientific work. So he is lauded there by actually the previous king as a great scientist.
Because he has a philosophical bent, he has a scientific bent, and this is something that the French like to
He is seen as a great philosopher and claimed almost as a Frenchman. In fact, when Franklin does arrive in France, there's a family who claims him as one of their own.
So I would have thought he would have felt more comfortable in France than he did in America, and yet you say he was dying to get back home.
Franklin does a very good job for most of the 8 years of pretending that he fits in beautifully. And he's the only American, in fact, who doesn't say, Paris is a hardship position. I'm actually quite at ease here. However, those last 2 years, he's quite sick. He's alone. And he's desperate to see what America has amounted to. Here's a man who's created a country which he's never set eyes on.
Of course, it was also the strength of the euro that was causing trouble.
That must be what it was.
Did he have a clear idea of what he was supposed to accomplish in France?
He's given a very, very loose set of orders, and in fact, later is given a somewhat contradictory set of orders. At one point, he's told that he might want to induce Versailles to help by offering up American territory, which the French are really not interested in. So he's really given a fairly loose portfolio, which he manages several ways. Nothing, in fact, will induce the French to enter the war until the victory at Saratoga, and Franklin pretty much knows that. He also figures that this is a waiting game, and that the numbers are on America's side. There will soon be more Americans than there are British. Ultimately, he really believes the colonies will win the war.
When they didn't hear from him at home, didn't they assume that he'd gone native?
No, I think there's a lot of animosity against Franklin in America, and so there was ample reason to say he's not doing his job, he's enjoying himself, he's at the opera every evening, which was, alas for Franklin, not true. They also knew there was a security issue, and Congress is constantly saying to Franklin and his colleagues, if you don't hear from us as often as you like, remember it is for your safety. Our silence is for your safety. I mean, there was a sense that it was impossible to communicate under those circumstances.
We will take a little break here, and then we'll come back with more, and we'll find out just why the Founding Fathers hated each other as much as they did. And that is one of the great revelations of this book from Stacy Schiff, who is the author of Vera, the book about Mrs. Vladimir Nabokov, which won the 2000 Pulitzer Prize in biography, also Saint-Exupéry, which was a finalist for the 1995 Pulitzer Prize. Her latest is called A Great Improvisation, Franklin, France, and the Birth of America. It's published by Henry Holt, and we will continue after this. I said the news is next. Of course, it was a moment of weirdness on my part. But we are talking about the news. It just happens to be the news of 1776.
18th century news, better than no news.
Stacy Schiff, the Pulitzer Prize winner, is here to talk about her latest book, A Great Improvisation, Franklin, France, and the Birth of America. It is published by Henry Holt. And you begin it with a cast of characters, a large cast of characters. This is like an American version of a Russian novel, spies and everything else.
Oh, I so hope not. You know, there are a lot of French names in this book, and that's partly where the cast of characters came in. I think it's hard to fathom the French names, and that net of spies I talked about has to be identified. So a lot of this is all of the informers from both sides.
I did ask you earlier if we knew who the spy in Congress was. Do we?
Yes, in the sense that he's sent very much above
street?
Board.
Did they name a street after him in Brooklyn like that? Named after all the other people in that Congress?
No, but he does send deliciously voluminous dispatches back so that we know pretty much. Those are years in which Congress pretty much destroys its own records for security's sake. So what we know of the happenings in Congress from those years, we know from him. And his name is Gérard, and he writes extremely long dispatches about every congressional dispute and essentially says the kind of things you would expect a foreigner to say about Congress. In other words, this government will never work. These people have nothing in common. And this body of men is all about self-interest.
Is it true that you read 9 years' worth of newspapers that Franklin would have read?
It is true. And, you know, there's nothing like reading an 18th century newspaper to make you grateful for the New York Post. I mean, it's...
Even for the New York Post.
Exactly. It's
but,
all
but
about...
But those page sixes were really exciting.
You know, and nothing's changed. It's all about who left, you know, whose spouse for whom, and the 106-year-old woman who had the baby, and the chicken who had cats for eggs. I mean, cats and her eggs, and you know, it's all the wonderful scandal stuff. It's immensely helpful. It's essentially a terrific way of seeing, first of all, what Franklin was living through during the French years. Secondly, how American independence was really seen by Europe. And thirdly, it's essentially because the press is controlled in those years, it's what the French government wanted the people to think.
But it's my sense that you hope to tell the story of the American Revolution from the European side to some degree by concentrating on Franklin's time in France. We never think about the European views of all of this and why they made some of the decisions they made.
Very much so, in the sense that we tend to think of the American Revolution as something that was, you know, born full-formed out of the head of George Washington, when, first of all, it could not have been accomplished without French aid. And secondly, it is part of a broader piece of history. I mean, the French need to avenge themselves on the British is essentially born out of the French and Indian War. And it is that sense, that seeking revenge, that makes the French so desperate to help us in our revolt against the British. And that is the crucial piece of our history that we'd prefer to forget.
Can we say that Benjamin Franklin was one of the first Americans to understand that we couldn't survive without political alliances?
I think Franklin understood that early on, in fact, very early on, or far earlier than even the Revolution. He's certainly the first American to see that we are not an island, that we are part of the larger world. He's the one who hangs maps of the world in the Pennsylvania Assembly. He really sees beyond the colonies. You know, Franklin has a few statements which are rather stunning, scientific statements, about the whole ecosystem, which show that he's thinking in a very holistic way on all levels. And that very much applies to the way he sees the world and the American colonies.
But there were a lot of colonists who didn't want to have anything to do with Europe They were fighting for independence from it. They wanted to create a whole new world.
Certainly the idea on the part of someone like, say, John Adams, who was a colleague of Franklin's, was let's get what we need from the French, and then let's hope that that wall of fire establishes itself mid-Atlantic and we never have to deal with them again. And the difference between that, between the Adams and the Franklin there, was that Franklin realized we would always be on the same planet, and it behooved us to maintain good relations with our friends and allies.
Well, weren't some of Franklin's colleagues in America concerned that he'd gotten too close to the French while he was in Paris, that he may have had divided loyalties?
Absolutely. Franklin is in the good graces of the French minister who keeps giving aid to the Americans. Adams's feel is that ultimatums should be delivered and that the French should be, you know, beaten around the head and ears to elicit more aid. Franklin realizes the French have no money, they've bankrupted themselves, and this is early on, far earlier than the French Revolution, and that they basically they're doing all they can. And moreover, they're our only benefactor. No one else in Europe is jumping up and down about this wonderful American Revolution. And he goes slowly. And, you know, when you asked me earlier what makes a good diplomat, Franklin is very aware of the fact that the less said, the better. And he proceeds with a kind of quiet that endears him to the French ministry. The kind of demands that his colleagues would like him to make immediately insult the French and get their backs up.
So what did he ask for and what did he get?
He asks for pretty much what Congress has told him he needs to request. I mean, he gets these 36-page shopping lists of everything that Washington's army needs. But he does an interesting...
10,000 muskets.
But and even more interesting than that, 10,000 muskets, exactly, uniforms for 30,000 men, and also chisels, paint, sheet music, jews' harps, clarinets, I mean, needles, everything you can possibly imagine. But he does something interesting. He doesn't just say, we need this aid because it is in your best interest to give it to us. We will be a wonderful trading partner for you. He essentially says, you know, we're the dear underdog. Wouldn't you like to come to our assistance? And he appeals to this sense of French, this French noble sense of rescuing the poor oppressed nation, which is exactly the right approach to have taken.
Of course, the French have their own oppressed, and we learn about that not all that much after the American Revolution. How much of a drain was the American Revolution on the French economy?
Directly responsible for the bankruptcy of the French government and therefore for the French Revolution. And that is really Franklin's single contribution to French history. He helps to drain the treasury, which, you know, topples the government, which, you know, kills the king, which brings which brings democracy to France. He does not see
those
that
ministers
coming.
Must have been thrilled, but of course they didn't realize it either.
The interesting thing is that many people around Franklin do see a sense of revolution brewing. And when Franklin is asked outright by various sort of liberal friends, could the kind of thing that is happening in America happen here, he, for whatever reason, says no. He thinks the French monarch is well-loved. He thinks the French government is stable. He has some sense, but not an entire sense, of how much he has drained the treasury. And he doesn't see the revolution coming.
And he didn't have any feeling of guilt about what he had done?
Fortunately, by that time, he was too dead to feel guilty. He becomes a kind of patron saint of the French Revolution.
Did the French see the connection? Were there any people writing about how we shouldn't have given all that money to the Americans?
That comes a little later. There's certainly a sense early on that that this is a dangerous business, that for a monarchy to support a rebel colony is a pretty dangerous idea.
But we have noblemen like Lafayette coming here to fight for our
but
cause.
Not for the ideals of democracy. Lafayette, like his fellow Frenchmen, comes to fight because there's no other war in which to make his or her his name. He comes for the very noble reason of establishing his reputation. And the ideals of liberty, fraternity, equality are not anywhere in the picture at that point.
If anything, he was escaping. He left a pregnant wife behind, didn't he?
He leaves an immense fortune and a pregnant wife to sail to America to make his name.
On the other hand, it probably saved his life after the Revolution, didn't it? Because he might have lost his head under other circumstances.
Yes, although fighting in America did not save a great number of other aristocrats in France. And in fact, almost to a man, everyone who helps the American cause during our Revolution will die in the French Revolution, either beheaded or shot or, you know, in some other sort of unsavory circumstance. And almost everyone who, in fact, sends munitions, sends aid, any kind of entrepreneur who helps us will go bankrupt because America does not pay its debts.
You've said that one of Franklin's skills was his ability to deal with all kinds of people and overlook their foibles. So how did that work with him, with the people back home who all seemed to hate him to some degree and hate each other as well?
Part of the price Franklin pays is having been gone for so long, and in his absence, and as I said, during the absence in which he writes relatively little, His colleagues in Paris, who have less to do, write often. So Congress is rather infected by their views of Franklin. And Franklin is not there to defend himself. And moreover, he doesn't write often enough to defend himself. So the cumulative sense in Congress is a certain amount of doubt about what Franklin is actually up to, and ultimately a certain animosity toward Franklin. At a certain point, just before he comes home, he says, I'm not sure anyone in Congress any longer knows who I am or what services I have performed for my country. It's a very poignant thing. He realizes he's paid the price for this long absence.
And was he treated poorly when he came back? I mean, Thomas Paine came back to America after having played such an important role in a revolution and was stoned in the streets of Philadelphia, if I remember correctly.
Franklin comes back unsure as to whether he's made the right decision to come back, because he's warned that he may be a prophet in his own time. And in fact, that is what he finds. He finds that there is no recompense for his debts. There is not a syllable of gratitude for his hard work in France. And the one thing he asks, which is that his grandson, who served as his secretary in Paris, be somehow granted a diplomatic posting, is never in fact granted.
So people didn't even recognize that he'd gotten them all that money to float the revolution?
I think it's a rather unsavory assignment that he's been saddled with to some extent. This is a chapter of our history that we'd rather forget. He is an old man who's been largely forgotten by these younger men in Congress. And the grandson was not well liked. Even Jefferson had problems with the grandson. So by pushing as hard as he did for this personal favor, he does alienate other people in Congress.
You mentioned earlier that he had some dalliances in France as well. I mean, he was a man in his 70s. I don't know how serious those dalliances were. But were Americans prudish about that sort of thing?
The dalliances that Franklin has in Paris are semi-serious. One of them I think he would have liked to have made very serious, but unfortunately the woman is not obliging. It's John Adams who really makes of Franklin the ladies' man of Paris, which he is not exactly. He's a very flirtatious man, but he's not really a ladies' man.
Adams is a man who is very monogamous, on top of it all, probably comes out of a puritanical
tradition.
Background.
Adams is the kind of man who can assure his children in his autobiography that they have no illegitimate siblings. And Franklin, of course,
sure,
is a man who has an illegitimate child, who sires an illegitimate child. So there's a difference right there between the two men. And yes, at first Adams is amused by Franklin's dalliances, as you put it, by the fact that French women seem to want to eat up Franklin. But ultimately, he's quite disillusioned by Franklin and writes him off as a dissolute.
Well, when Franklin entered a theater, I gather, people would stand and applaud the way they might have applauded the king or some French hero.
It was almost impossible for him to go out without creating a sensation in the streets. As one diplomat says early on, he had no place to hide. His image is everywhere. His image is better known than any other face in France. He really can't appear in the streets without people applauding and following his carriage.
Were you surprised at how badly the founding fathers seemed to get along with each other?
Well, the American history I had learned had presented a sort of cohesive band of founding fathers, yes, who worked together to form this great republic. So I was struck by two different things. I was struck by how little cooperation there is among both the crew in Paris and the crew in Congress. And I was struck by how Franklin sort of is at fault for some of this, how Franklin is, in fact, a rather difficult colleague. He's unforthcoming. He's as reticent as he is to the great cause of diplomacy. He makes for a very difficult colleague.
There was a little bonhomie when he was with his friends. There was no backslapping there.
He's a charming, charming, flirtatious man, but he's also wholly unforthcoming. And if you're meant to be his colleague, that must have been appalling. His celebrity is difficult for his fellow Americans to handle. He's really unmethodical. He's a terrible family man. He's a terrible administrator. He's a terrible accountant. For various reasons, he would have been an exceptionally difficult colleague.
And then he had those other problems that we don't normally think about. He was besieged by men who wanted to go to America and fight. They sought his permission or asked him how they could go about that?
Early on, Franklin says that he's terrified by the sound of every carriage in his courtyard because he realizes that every young son of an aristocratic family is desperate to make his name, the way Lafayette does, and is very eager to come to America. And he can't go out to dinner without the person on his left and the person on his right both saying, my second cousin twice removed would desperately like to be commissioned in the American Army. And he fortunately realizes this is a huge public relations problem for George Washington and puts his foot down. But it's extremely difficult. He's besieged by these people.
You get the feeling that he would have made a great PR man. He was very aware of public relations.
Very much so. And the kind of anthems that he does go around Paris singing are rather, they're extraordinary even today. I mean, these great lines about, you know, tyranny is so greatly established in the rest of the world that the prospect of an asylum for liberty in America makes all of Europe happy. And, you know, blessed be the Americans to be called by Providence to this port of honor. They're beautiful, beautiful statements, when in fact he was working completely in a vacuum and had no idea of what was going on in the colonies.
Was Thomas Jefferson, who was a Francophile, an ally to any degree in this?
Jefferson comes late. He arrives in 1784. Franklin leaves in 1785. Jefferson will succeed Franklin. The two of them do get along beautifully. But Jefferson's initial reaction to Paris is not the happy reaction we remember. He spends the first months essentially complaining about French morals, French women, the darkness of the sky, and essentially how uncomfortable he is in Paris.
I wonder about Franklin as a choice of subject for you. I realize there's a French connection here, Saint-Exupéry, even Vera, Mrs. Nabokov, because they spent so much time in France. Is that how you came to Franklin?
You know, I'm not sure you can ever account entirely for how you came to a subject. This was, I guess there are two relationships here. One is I think of Franklin as a great writer. And there was a literary attraction there. He's a sublime stylist. The sentences are crystal clear. He never has to redraft a sentence. He's a remarkably synthetic thinker and a beautiful stylist on the page.
Did people recognize that at the time?
He's known as the best writer in the colonies at the time, obviously. In Europe, I'm not sure anyone ever remarks on his writing. It's really stunningly beautiful. And especially, even if you compare him to the other founding fathers, there's just a felicity of prose.
Because we always think of Jefferson as the great writer.
Jefferson is an amazingly elegant writer, but a more ornate writer. And the second one is that this is the flip side of the American Revolution. And I guess I always thought of the Nabokov book in a way as the other side of the tapestry, an oblique way of getting at Nabokov. This was a way of putting the revolution in context and seeing Franklin out of context, where he's more visible, more approachable, and more himself, in fact, which is, of course, the point of biography.
He seems to me to be a lot easier to understand by people today than some of the other revolutionaries. That's perhaps why there's another book about George Washington out by David McCullough. I gather it's a fabulous book, and I hope to read it sometime soon. But Washington does seem a bit more mysterious because we're not sure what his motives are, whereas Franklin does seem like somebody we would recognize in the current political scene.
You know, I think,
or maybe a publishing scene.
The three who drive John Adams crazy for their reticence are Washington, Jefferson, and Franklin. And of those three, I think Franklin is the easiest to get a grasp on. First of all, he commits more to paper than the other two, or more of himself, I guess you could say, to paper than the other two. No one commits as much of himself to paper as John Adams. But Franklin is, he's rather plain about certain things and rather forthright about certain things. And he's got a sense of humor, which I guess you could say is lacking with George Washington.
Did that plainness play a part in his relations with the French? Did they see Americans as sophisticated, or did they see them as natural men? Did they see Franklin as something of an innocent, perhaps?
Well, this is the great irony, that Franklin, the ultimate sublimely manipulative negotiator, is greeted in France as this representation of Rousseau's natural man, the incarnation of the new American, this new breed of people. He's greeted as this sort of country philosopher, this country rustic, and here's a man who's never lived outside of a city in his life. I mean, he's taken for something utterly different from what he is. And, of course, he doesn't take it upon himself to enlighten anyone. He just assumes that mantle, walks around in his fur hat for the first 6 months, and lives up to his reputation as this kind of rustic philosopher.
Where do you go from here? Do you have another project in mind?
There's another 18th century subject on my mind, but, you know, Franklin's a hard one to escape. He's very, very charming.
When you write a biography, is it like writing? I know you haven't written a novel, but novelists will tell me that once they've lived with a character for a couple of years, even though they're ready to move on to something else, those characters continue to talk to them.
Absolutely. You continue to go to the movies with Franklin on one side of you and Nabokov on the other side of you. It's a strange combination, you have to admit. But there's also with Franklin a great sense of self-contradiction, and that, I think, is what keeps the conversation going in the back of my mind. There's nothing in Franklin which you couldn't contradict with something else of Franklin's.
Well, Nabokov was another taciturn man, wasn't he?
not as much so. Franklin is truly recessive. And, you know, that was, for me, was a revelation as well. I always thought of him as a great talker. We know so much of Franklin's sayings. He seems so present. We know he sits in on all of those conventions. I didn't realize he sat in on all those conventions silently in his chair and then let drop the one epigrammatic statement for which he is now remembered. So he was really, he's really a rather recessive personality.
Stacy Schiff will be giving a reading this Thursday at 7 o'clock at 192 Books. That's on 10th Avenue between 21st and 22nd Streets. Her latest book, A Great Improvisation, Franklin, France, and the Birth of America, is published by Henry Holt and has gotten just fabulous reviews, all deserved, I might add.
Thanks, Leonard.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for checking out today's podcast of The Leonard LoPage Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.